Well, hi everybody and welcome. This is Dave. Welcome to our final seminar in the Change and Transition series. I'm eager to hear any questions or thoughts or reflections that any of you have that you'd like to discuss before we move into our material. Are there any remaining questions that any of you have that I haven't answered? Or new ones that you have that have come up over the course of our discussions. So all of your questions are answered. Anything else you'd like to elaborate about or discuss or any challenges that you'd like to bring up in any aspect of what you're doing that that we could discuss?
Dave, this is Peter in North Carolina.
Welcome. Hey, thanks. Go ahead.
Hey, I just have a question. It's more of an administrative one. How long will the recordings be up on the website after the class finishes?
CTA leaves them up for 30 days after the final class.
Okay, great. Thank you.
The best information I have. Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm. And the one from like today should be posted. Bill should post that tomorrow. So thanks, Peter. Any other thoughts or questions or things you'd like to discuss?
Well, hi, Dr. Dave. This is Naomi.
Hey, welcome. How are you?
Thank you. I'm good. You know, I was listening to the third session, the roadmap, and I just thought it was very interesting of the client you had that was seeking perfection and that was when she always had a problem with the job. And I just it kind of struck a chord with me that was a different way of looking at it, always seeking perfection and never getting things done, creating that conflict.
I think that's a nice reflection, and I appreciate the follow-up on that. Yeah, that was a particular recognition that she had in her practice, and despite being immensely successful, she wasn't really enjoying it. And really, once she came to align her needs and her ideals with her goals and strategies and look at attainable goals and strategies, it really worked much, much better. So that was an internal transition for her. And we've talked about various areas, various kinds of change and transition throughout our three seminars. I'm going to talk about the more specific aspects of that in just a bit, but thanks for your comment. Yeah, I'm glad you found that was useful.
Yes, thank you.
Beth, other questions or things you'd like to talk about? Well, I will move into our discussion then, and we'll have a bit more time at the end, so it'll be back to you for any discussion questions. Thoughts you'd like to talk about then. We're going to talk about specific challenges and opportunities in transitions. The first thing I'd like to talk about, and this is kind of applying and bringing together some of what we've talked about throughout the three seminars, I'd like to apply that first to transition niche coaching. I'll tell you what I mean by that. Practicing professionals such as healthcare, financial, legal, have in common that they've dedicated their careers to a body of knowledge. Their clients come to them for the purpose of purchasing their expertise to solve problems and give specific advice is backed by their professional standards and substantiated by laws or codes. So, even with rigorous training to solve specialized problems and provide specialized advice, professionals probably have not been trained to know themselves better, to understand the dynamics of human behavior, to remove stress as an obstacle to their success, to pursue personal development as vigorously as they pursue professional development, to convert from work ethic to performance ethic, as the example that Naomi just alluded to emotionally and strategically manage career transitions. They've assumed they do one thing, the profession they're trained for all their lives. Another genre, performance professionals, includes actors and professional athletes. The primary challenges they have is self-regulation, to stay grounded in their ideals and energy management in the face of extraordinary demands and stimulating success, especially retirement transitions for some. Now, I mention those as just simply illustrations in a process that we've been looking at to get you to think about the application for what we're talking about in terms of change and transitions to the particular group of people you're working with, perhaps first yourself, to look at where you are in a change and transition process, to then apply that to working with clients and to extract some principles here. And here's the first that I want to talk about, a lesson that we can learn about the importance of self-regulation for all loss, change, and transition. Champion sports figures are alert to the importance of aftermath, the points or play immediately following a tense and hotly contested moment of play. Both the winner and the loser of these intense encounters tend to be compromised somewhat because they're dealing with big success or big failure. The loser is frustrated, which carries over into errors or trying to work. The aftermath point and plays are likely to be lost on errors. The wise player approaches the aftermath with self-regulation, conservatively, and with full concentration. Here's an example. The announcers at a Texans game on defensive lineman Casey. That's so often the case with young players. One good play and then one bad one. After doing a spectacular tackle on the next play, Casey was offsides. This is an instance of self-regulation and being on tilt, the excitement from making a really good play. Now, this is something I want to consider for your listening to clients about their dealing with not only setbacks but successes as they move forward in various changes and transitions. Success does not create an immunity to failure. A loss does not foreshadow lack of confidence or disbelief. The next play is the next play. The next point is the next point. You've lost something very important, but tomorrow is still another day. Your next career, for example, is the same thing. This is the aftermath of everything that you've done before, everything that you've worked hard for. It will stand alone on its own. Additional people who have significant challenge in dealing with the emotions of a transition are the ones whose process begins with a significant and often abrupt loss. Job, significant relationship, disability, divorce, retirement. Think about all of these aspects of people you deal with, even as niches in your practice. With these changes and subsequent transitions, the need for help in managing emotions and regulating states of mind is important in and of itself. Then, this task becomes important as it affects other components of a situation. For example, the significant emotion of a divorce in the subsequent divorce proceedings and asset management creates challenges such as making the business aspect of a divorce only about the business of divorce and not letting emotional factors derail logic and judgment. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older and become more immune to change and transition. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place in one position get most entrenched. Another place that I see this resistance in mentor coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he started 36 years ago to his two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles, relationships, and duties. And I'm doing a series of retreats with a good buddy and colleague called What's Next Exec, or current senior executives and CEOs who are within a year or so of retirement. It's designed to help them create an informed and masterful transition to their next contribution or their next career. Many of these people we've seen at this at these retreats have been in corporate America for three decades or more and want to retire to perhaps pursue their own business or consulting or other career, but they probably haven't had the experience of setting and collecting professional fees, of operating by creating their own structure. They've been surrounded and supported by a corporate structure. So their challenge is analogous to those of you who move from a paid position to opening your own practices. You know much of what they're going through. They've never had to market their services. They've never had to set up a PayPal account or establish a business name or find somebody to do a website. So retired is not an identity. For them, it's the lack of one, and it's the beginning of a new phase. So think about this. In all of the transitions, all of the changes that we've been talking about, and as you reflect on your clients who are dealing with this, let's consider this question. What do clients really want from us as mentor coaches? I'll tell you what I think since you ask. The mentor coach and client become co-authors of that new story and create a current meaning that allows a distinctness of the old versus new in an evolving new story. We are always teaching others how to respond to us. A client is always teaching us exactly what it's like to be him or her, creating an in vivo demonstration of what needs to be known so that we can teach it back to the client out loud. We have to be open to that learning and not let teaching the client our theories or let our agenda or our biases get in the way. Although we inevitably listen within the context of our own system of meaning and knowing, we continuously bridge to the experience and system of meaning of the client. In this co-created space, the client develops an authentic story. What our clients want from us as mentor coaches, I believe, is the adult version of what we as children wanted from our parents. Our clients want unself-conscious participation in serious work and sometimes in play. Remember, my favorite grandmother said, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. They want acceptance of praise without embarrassment or deflection so that we can give it back to them as their as its creator as self-statement. They praise us because they need to be praised themselves, and that's missing. And we give it back to them as an accurate mirror. They want full immersion in, yet not full reaction to, their full feelings, never losing sight of their internal perspective and their best interest. To hope that we will see the self the client hopes to become and see the evolving new story that sometimes gets obscured from the client's view. To see at times a thought, a feeling, or a behavior as an answer to a question its creator has not consciously dared to ask. Now, I got that from X-Files, but I'm sticking with it. To hope that we hear the silent intent embedded in the compromised result, to see the hope camouflaged in their sometimes frustrating process, and to validate their intuition. To hope that we will not be awkward, self-conscious, or say anything that would distract from the client's immersion in his or her process. The architecture of trust silently forms while we talk about other things. Collaborating together, even laughing together, gives oxygen to hope, highlights the relief and release of new experiences, and pushes creativity to full flight. We help the client mourn the old story. We know that no matter how ready to change they are, it's still like saying goodbye to an old friend who's been there for a long time. The client mourns the self that he leaves behind, the self of the old story. Invention can be sabotaged and creativity imprisoned by her remaining in an old story, repeating the same storylines. Julia Cameron said it beautifully in The Artist's Way. I am astounded that I could let go of the drama of being a starving artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. We are in the present moment together and co-create a new story with our clients. We believe in someone until they can believe in themselves, and they'll teach us both why. The corollary to believing in the client is that the coach must be the kind of person in whom the client can believe and respect and trust. The client has to believe that the coach will respond, guide, teach, and model in a way that facilitates optimum growth. This bond, this immersion and understanding within the present moment, may be one of the most powerful and most change-making experiences the client has ever had. Most likely, the most powerful. I remain curious about how my clients continue to write their narratives after we end formal coaching. I believe that coaching is a developmental process continuing in its influence throughout life. I have said to clients, I'm going to be your coach for life, though regular meetings will be necessary only for a short period of time. Intervals of updates, quarterly, at least yearly, can be beneficial for both coach and client, sort of like booster shots. Witnessing a continuing developmental journey at regular intervals. In other words, something doesn't have to go wrong in order to look again at the whole picture and the process. What we do with each client is not about being right, having pristine theory and technique, or even mutually idealizing achievement. But the bottom line is always this: does it work? Coaching allows the beauty of waking up to specific possibilities, strength, untapped resources. We help people become more of who they really are. The client must risk bringing an issue to the table and further that risk by looking at it. And the exchange must be worthy and true. It must be real. The coach has to be fully present, fully himself or herself. Hemingway captured this principle, I believe, when he wrote about the craft of writing. Write the truest sentence you know. As we nudge a client to consider their relationship with themselves, we wonder, sometimes out loud, let's look at that storyline and your purpose. How exactly are you taking care of yourself? I ask clients toward the beginning how often they work out, what they do for their physical health, as well as spiritual and other ones. And I not so gently nudge them if it's not 5 to 6 times a week. We'll discuss wellness story in just a moment. How are you honoring your needs and ideals? Your relationships. Have you created something now that seems to be controlling you? Are you framing yourself by your gender, your role, your purpose? Do you find things to be grateful for daily, to celebrate daily? An ideal coaching co-creation is to reflect or validate the client, to tell the client what they already know and just a little bit more. The little bit more may be a challenge, a conceptualization, a nudge toward initiative or action, or a reminder to pause momentarily to consider, contemplate, or simply celebrate. So, how we facilitate change in coaching, I believe, is captured in these 12 caveats. These are principles that focus on facilitating change in the mentor-coaching relationship. 1, each person's life story is created. Recognition and acceptance of story ownership is a prerequisite to assessment and change. 2, understanding begins with examinations of which storylines work and which don't. Pardon me. and then to change the ones that don't. The ones that do work need to be kept, possibly enhanced. And that's the simplest principle of coaching that I know. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't, do something different. Three, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. Four, distinguish what to change, accept, let go, and enhance. Those four aspects, change, accept, let go, and enhance. Placing energy into what works, coupled with accepting and letting go what cannot be changed, can result in significant effectiveness. Five, when people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. Questions direct, clarify, illuminate, and even story bust. And we know in coaching that asking the right question has more power than giving people the right answers. We also know that appreciative inquiry can get much better results than seeking out and solving problems. Six, someone has to change an internal model of assumptions to sustain a new story. Seven, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. Learn to recognize your own assumptions and beliefs and how they color what's perceived. Assumptions manifest as feelings and behaviors. By making assumptions explicit, those which facilitate and those which interfere can both become visible. 8. Change is constant and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that generates most problems. People are most successful when they learn from yesterday, anticipate tomorrow, and integrate the impact of new experience. If someone is protesting change, they've already engaged it. 9. Small changes lead to big changes. Issues that seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue to specify a step to take for progress. For example, professionals get overwhelmed with the amount of tasks and responsibilities. Don't be afraid to get simple. Focus on and clarify one issue that can be dealt with effectively within the next day. This focus on a specific action exercises effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery. 10. Solutions, causes, and problems are not always related or even interconnected. A therapist attunes to problems, conflict, and development for progress to occur. Coaching uses this space to focus on creating a new story, to look at possibilities rather than problems, to align a client's needs and values, to strategize toward a goal. The coach listens to join talents and strengths with possibilities and vision to strategically pursue goals. 11. A collaboration keeps both individuals on the same side looking at the scene together. Empathic resonance generates feeling understood. Then you can make powerful coaching interventions. Also, validation of what is positive will have several times the effect of focus on the negative. A comment perceived as judgmental often results in a defensive reaction. 11. The benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what's not will become evident and self-perpetuating. Again, don't be afraid to be simple. A physician client who's completed the 26th grade probably has forgotten how to talk simply. Remember, how you work with your client provides a model that will be imitated and internalized of how they work with their clients or their employees or their patients. Now, I want to spend just a little bit of time talking about your wellness story. A significant aspect of change and transition is to build in a wellness story. If it's not there already, wellness is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to the individual. With this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you get a new car every few years, the approach would be really different than if you knew from the very beginning you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do research to know the best care for that car, probably change the oil more frequently, do everything possible for maintenance. Knowing it would be the only car for the rest of your life, you take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It's a closed system. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. Wellness is a system of energy. And wellness is an ongoing process of choices. It's never static. We never stay at the same place. So it constantly, consistently needs to be assessed. Wellness is not something you begin to plan at 65 or even age 50. Rather, every choice you make each day writes your wellness story. Now, here's an illustration of those little choices. Overall wellness is not based on the big monumental choice, but on little things. You plan to run 30 minutes on the treadmill, but get off after 10, convinced you're a little stiff today. It's a small choice, no big deal. Nobody has a heart attack because of 20 minutes less on a treadmill one day. You resolve to cut empty calories, but then grab a few M&Ms from the candy bowl, not thinking about the choice, because no single M&M, not even five, caused anyone to have diabetes. But consider this. Take in 100 calories more each day than you burn. And each year that you do that, you gain 9 pounds each year. Our wellness success is the cumulative result of daily choices that we don't rationalize away or justify into oblivion. We are in a revolution in the science of wellness and aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives now than anyone in all of biological time. This has taken a while because health is biologically way more complex than disease. I want to talk for just a minute about decay and growth. The story that we engage with our bodies is one of two possibilities. This is an either or, decay or growth. Dr. Henry Lodge Jr., author of Younger Next Year and Younger Next Year for Women, has devoted over 35 years of his professional life as an internist in New York City to wellness research. And he's found that 70% of aging is not aging, but decay. If we assume that ailments and deterioration are a normal part of growing old, and that we diminish activity and deteriorate physically as well as in quality of life, the change on the cellular level will be decay. Inactivity, the absence of signals to grow, result in body and brain decay. Another story, the alternate story, is that both decay and functional aging are largely optional. This alternate story is growth. We send signals to our body of daily exercise, emotional meaning, good nutrition, zest for living. Here's a quote from Dr. Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. The new wellness story includes a central storyline of exercise. No negotiation, no excuses, serious exercise. According to Dr. Lodge, after age 50, 6 days a week for the rest of your life is mandatory. Lodge emphasizes that four of those 6 days of exercise need to be serious aerobic exercise the rest of your life. Biologically, your body only knows two things, growth or decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body and each bathe cells in repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels, and it's wounded blood vessels that kill us. Mortality falls with exercise. Of over 300 of over 3,000 people surveyed, three activities stood out above all others as ones that prompted procrastination. More than anything else, people put off exercise, a healthier nutritional plan, and a retirement savings plan. Short-term desires trump long-term goals, and emotions and immediate gratification rule, because all of these notions are abstract and long-term. They don't have the immediate payoff of cheesecake. On the other hand, work duties, projects, and assignments are responded to routinely and promptly. So this is what I want to emphasize as a mindset change in this change in transition. Work duties, projects, assignments, those are what we think of as work. We just do those. We go to work because it works there. That's what we do. That's the mindset. So this suggests that a task such as exercise could be treated with the same mindset as work. With work, you don't have to get up every day and debate about whether you will or you won't work, whether you're going to take off a couple of days or just skip it, or bargain and say, well, I'm going to skip this work, I'm going to really get with it starting next Tuesday. Or feel virtuous if you do work out. Work is there. You get up, you go to work, you don't debate about it. You show up. It's an organizing force. It's a deeply etched default mode. You go to work every day, whatever constitutes work, even full-time parenting. Exercise can be the same mindset. Now, for some, this is like a new job. It's a commitment, a serious commitment. It requires a plan, just like your business. According to Lodge, daily exercise, like work, should be right up there, trumped only by serious illness or family needs, the default story. Now, as a mentor coach, you're not a personal trainer. You're not a dietitian. You're not giving directives, but you can make informed recommendations, and you can listen to how your client takes information and makes choices to write his or her next chapter. And you're always free to challenge the choices or even the trail of logic leading to them and their fulfillment. Here are two things that I want to underscore here. Two things above all others create neurogenesis, the making of new cells in our brains: enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. That's exactly what we do in mentor coaching. The hippocampus is part of the midbrain, especially connected with two things: creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Physical exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. And in recent studies, in non-invasive studies, in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students, the same findings, the same percentage are replicated. Another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis, especially in the hippocampus. And remember the two primary functions of the hippocampus: memory and creativity. The Power of Story has another chapter created by athletes taking human growth hormone and those taking a placebo. The group receiving a placebo believed they were getting human growth hormone, and they improved at four fitness tests measuring strength, endurance, power, and sprint capacity. They lived into the story that they believed. We do this with our clients by creating a new story that they live into. There's no placebo. We don't have to create anything. It's not that we believe in the client. We create a plan and a structure that they then live into. Now, let's look at how does this apply for looking at ourselves in the future. Well, there's some interesting studies about that. Emily Pronin, a Princeton research psychologist, found that in making financial decisions, especially how much money we put toward retirement, depends on how closely we identify with our future selves. If people have an image of themselves in the future, if they can conjure an image of themselves, they say 3 to 4 times as much as people who do not conjure an image of themselves in the future. Now, Stanford did some enhanced imaging progression techniques on the computer to look at how this would impact people, and they found something very similar. When people are age progressed to show what their 70 and 80-year-old selves would look like, they save more. When it's a progression to look like what they will look like if they continue smoking versus if they don't smoking, it's a vivid depiction. They don't have to imagine. They can see evidence, and it has a direct impact on behavior. Brain imaging reveals that the greater activity in the area of the brain called the anterior cingulate cortex is activated when we imagine ourselves in the future. And the more alignment we have with that future self, it will make practical and substantial benefits with what we do to align ourselves to that future identity, including, for example, simply doing healthier things and saving more. When people showed a lesser activity in thinking about their current and future self, they tended to save less money, work out less, and not eat as healthily. The conclusion of these studies was that encouraging people to imagine themselves in the future could have substantial benefits. Now, your story hides in plain sight. Think about the difference of people who lead a reactive life where circumstances and others determine their decisions and directions, who talk about what they're going to do, but who do the same thing week after week. Now, contrast that to those who accomplish and believe and create a different story, and their lives embody that story for themselves and others. Their story, their plot, guides them and orients them to consciously write and evolve a new story with a growth mindset. Now, throughout these seminars, we've talked about how someone's story is hiding in plain sight. It's in the open, waiting to be seen, then transformed. In these seminars, we've been discussing how to help people write the next chapter of their life, their business, their wellness, their career stories. Consider these questions. If your story to this point would be published as a book, what would the title and subtitle be? Think about it and write it down, because you already know. It'll come to you instantly. When you write something down instantly like that, that's when you engage your emotional brain instead of thinking about it and editing and doing all those convolutions. If your story builds to a major achievement in the near future, what would that be? Write it down immediately. Describe a scenario in your story in which you, the protagonist, faced a major setback that brought out the best in you to successfully overcome it. Write the name of that episode, then you can go back and reflect on it later. What aspects of your story do you want to enhance? First two things that come to mind. What aspects of your story do you want to leave out as you move ahead? First two things that come to mind. What event or process foreshadows your next success? Immediately write it down. You already know it. What roles will the most important people in your life play as you go forward? Write down the names, first names of the two most important people, and then come back later and look at how the roles are shifting. This is going to be a challenge because there are hardly words to describe this. What is your spiritual essence? Write down whatever comes to you. Remember, you don't have to be religious in order to have spiritual meaning, significance, and purpose. Now, I want to conclude with a couple of things. One is to look at the life stages of success. So we're looking at change and transformation with, we've been looking with the microscopic lens. We've been looking at the regular lens with the wide-angle lens. We're looking at time-lapse photography now. Success may mean different things at different points in life, at each developmental phase. And I want to share with you a quote that I think captures so much of this for three or four of the most important ones. Here's how it looks in a relationship. And this is from Ruby Dee, "I Dream a World." It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within the marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. And here's a way of looking at individual success from my favorite philosopher, Goethe. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes and hopes of his early youth invariably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. Dreams change. We realize some, we relinquish some, we create new ones. Growth is flexible and dynamic, hopefully. Once you achieve monetary success and professional prestige, you can figure out what's really important. Now, what's missing in that? Ideally, you've done it before, and that's part of the purpose and the result of success. A caveat, be sure success doesn't constrict you from doing what you really want to do. And here's that time-lapse photo from a different perspective from my favorite essayist, Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. Now, I'd like to do a final exercise with you. I'd like you to close your eyes and get very relaxed and be aware of how fully and comfortably your seat is holding you. Take a deep breath in to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension. And be aware of how completely relaxed your body is. Do that again. Breathe another breath in of relaxation, breathing out any tension. Now, with your eyes closed, imagine you're 90 years old. Look back at yourself now. Look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How would they turn out on a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change or even a transition? What kind? Be specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see that you might have really seen right now but didn't acknowledge? What do you feel about your situation now? What do you want to tell yourself now? For example, any turns or cautions or risk that you should or shouldn't have taken. And consider this carefully, but immediately, your immediate first answer. What is your unlived life? Now, keep your eyes closed and look carefully at your 90-year-old eyes. Your face. Your hands. Your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are. And at who's there with you. Remember, you always know more than you think. Okay, emerge from that in a slow way and gradually open your eyes. We're in discussion mode now, so I'll ask you to manage the background noise. Your thoughts, your questions. Anything you'd like to discuss further, or any reflections that you have about your experience. I'd ask you to manage the background noise. Anytime you move paper or make movements, it's picked up by your microphone. So stay on mute until you're ready to talk if there's any movement or any happening in around you. Your thoughts?
Dave, this is Kip.
Hey, Kip. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hey, I came out of it realizing that I need to take more risk to change and at the same time to be mindful of the small things to take risk with, so that I'm not settling in the same patterns every day, but rather looking for ways to shift the path. I think of golfers like Tiger Woods, where, and compared to a normal golfer who doesn't hit the ball quite as hard and far, and if I make a small shift like they do when they're hitting, mm-hmm. you know, into the future a long way, it really makes a big difference in where it's going to end up compared to if I hit a smaller shot. So I've been playing around with the notion of giving myself permission to take more risks moment to moment rather than looking for the big hit. And so that just came to me, and I'm playing with it. So thank you for that meditation. That was really nice.
That's a great application, Kip. Thanks. Thanks very much for sharing that. I think that's a terrific way to think about it. And that really is shrinking the change to one step at a time, and what's the next best thing to do. And as we've talked before, you know, in life, all we ever have to do is the next best thing, because we do the next best thing, and then we ask, what's the next best thing? As long as we have a plan of where we're going to and have those steps be in a considered direction, then it's a dynamite way to do it. Yeah, so thanks.
Thank you.
Other questions or thoughts?
Dr. Davis, Naomi.
Please.
I think that what I got out of the meditation was that I don't think I've really developed my future, the picture of my future self as much. I found it kind of hard. Yeah, what will I look like at 90? And I, you know, what did I want? What were my situations? And so I think I need to do more to develop the picture of the vision of my future self, so that would be my motivation for what I need to do now.
That's a great, let me ask for background management, because I hear somebody talking background. That's a great application, and if it did that, then terrific. That's exactly what I think is a very useful application to what's significant for each of you in terms of each of your stories, you know, money, financial, wellness, everything that is important.
And it was especially in the realm of the wellness.
Okay, yeah.
You know, when you said over 50 and you should be exercising 6 days a week, and I know it to be so, but I think that visualization of what I want my future, what I want to look like in the future, helps bring that much more into a reality to say, oh, yeah, I really do need to make some changes.
Yeah. Yeah, I worked out 3, maybe 4 times a week until I did some collaboration with Lodge, and we presented together and read each other's work, and I became very familiar with his work. And since then, I regularly do 6 days a week. It's made a terrific contribution to my sense of energy, and it's something that, you know, I totally get and apply. You know, you just do it each day. You don't find time to do it. I don't schedule anything. I do it looking at my biorhythms when I kind of naturally, you know, would rather take a nap like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I schedule my workout. I'm at the gym every day at 2 o'clock and on the Stairmaster when the market closes at 3, and nothing is scheduled during that time ever, because that's the workout. It's treated just like work, and it's a routine deal as part of my schedule, and it's made a tremendous difference. It's more than benefited the time and energy and effort that I put into it, and that's exactly what he's found in working with lots of people. And that book I would recommend, Younger Next Year for Women, or Younger Next Year. You know, I'm getting younger and smarter every year. So
I like that. I always say that actually is my motto, but now I need to make it a reality.
Make it official, yeah. Mindset, it's, you know, you're getting more intelligent. Intelligence is not fixed. You're getting smarter every year. With, you know, with this, with wellness, you're getting younger every year. So hey.
and what was the author again? I'm sorry.
Henry Lodge, Lodge Jr.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for your comments. Who else? I'm interested in your thoughts and your impact. What are you thinking? What kind of questions do you have? If there's nothing else that you have, we'll wrap up here. I want to emphasize to you, if you have any questions or follow-up, you have my email. I would welcome any correspondence and welcome any questions you have. If I can be of help to you in any way, please let me know. Thank you for all of your participation, all the initial responses that you had to the questions that I asked. I appreciate it very, very much, and I hope this has been beneficial to you, and I hope it will marinate in ways that will continue to be of some benefit to you. So thank you all very, very much, and let me know if I can be of help to you. Bye now. Thank you again.
There you go.